This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. How to deal with homelessness and what and when should police use force are basic issues which are front and center in Cincinnati and Hamilton County this week. To review the week's developments, we are joined today by WVXU Hamilton County Courthouse reporter Bill Reinhart, WCPO.com reporter Lucy May, and Cincinnati Enquirer breaking news reporter Cameron Knight. If you'd like to join the conversation, please call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Twitter and Facebook. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks. Friday.
Happy to be here.
Time to look back. Bill, what are the issues around these homeless camps, and how have they changed in the past week? And I'm particularly thinking in a legal sense.
Well, it depends on who you ask what the issue is. You ask the homeless advocates, they say it's all about there's not enough affordable housing. There's nowhere, and they say there's not enough room in the shelters. You ask some of the city leaders, they say this is a public health issue. You can't have people living on the streets, doing their business, doing drugs. They say it's not healthy. And so they've gotten the courts involved and said you can't stay here on 3rd Street or underneath Fort Washington Way. You have to move. And in two different instances in the last week, they have moved a couple of camps. And each time the camp picks up and moves a few blocks over and reestablishes itself. And that camp is soon got police and city workers come knocking at the proverbial door saying you can't stay here either.
Yeah.
In the process of this and going ending up in court a couple of times, Lucy, it's my understanding that it's not just a city of Cincinnati question anymore. It's now the orders have been extended countywide. Is that correct?
Right. When Mayor John Cranley got kind of at the end of his rope, his breaking point seems to have come when the city cleared one camp near 3rd and Plum Streets that was kind of under an overpass. Those folks left. A lot of them got into shelter or different programs, but some did move to other locations. There were a lot of tents along the sidewalk on 3rd Street. There was a lot of, upset over that whole thing. Those finally got cleared, but as soon as the city cleaned up the sidewalk, the tents came back, and that seemed to be kind of the mayor's breaking point. He said, I'm going to involve Joe Dieters. So the following Monday, the Hamilton County prosecutor filed a temporary restraining order. Judge Robert Ruhlman agreed that this was a public health and safety issue and agreed with the assertion on that the mayor and Joe Dieters are making that there's plenty of room in shelters to handle these folks, that they just don't want to go there. So the first boundary covered all homeless camps south of Central Parkway, reaching from about the Mill Creek to Mount Adams. Folks cleverly moved their tents just north of Central Parkway across from the casino. Then the prosecutor successfully got the judge to amend the boundary so that it went all the way from Norwood, all the way up to the Norwood Lateral from interstate to interstate. Then folks moved their tents just past the I-71 interstate right across from WCPO on Gilbert Avenue. That happened yesterday, but that didn't last long because Joe Dieters went back to the judge and the judge has declared the ban affects the entire all of Hamilton County. Now, the interesting thing is the ban only affects public places, and we have a story on our website right now that some of the tents and the folks have relocated to an area at 13th and Republic Streets and over the Rhine, which is private property. So a private property owner at this point can allow folks to camp there.
And that property apparently is owned by a group called People's Co-op LLC. Their mailing address is also held by the Over the Rhine Community Housing Group.
Okay. Which does develop affordable housing.
I mean, yes.
That is their purpose.
Yes.
And helps people get out of homelessness. They also operate what's called permanent supportive housing, which is especially right for people who are experiencing homelessness long term, is an important step to independence. So that's housing where people can go in there, get shelter, but have a case manager who works with them to make sure that they're getting medications they need or mental health counseling or addiction treatment or whatever it is that's a barrier to their long-term stability.
Yeah, and their view is housing first, and then let's deal with the various issues that may be driving that once we get people into housing. So that's right there. Cameron, so, okay, there is this encampment now at 13th and Republic. That sounds similar to an offer that was made by Damon Lynch III that there could be people who came out to property of his church in Roselawn, but that was turned down.
As far as I know, yes, I haven't been following this story very closely.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, Lucy probably knows a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, Mark Carnute actually had a story in the paper this morning. Still a subscriber,
yeah.
He said that that the Reverend Lynch did offer his church's property, that some of the folks that were staying at the camp didn't want to go that far. That's in Roselawn, and it might not seem like a long stretch to somebody who has a car, but if you don't have a car, if you don't have access to transportation, that's a pretty far way to go to the services that many of these folks need, and those services are concentrated typically in the urban core.
And a few, 10 days ago, we had a show that we devoted to this, and we had Mary Magdalene House, for example, represented on that show, which is a place that people can get really basic services,
right.
Showers, haircuts,
laundry,
mm-hmm. phone, pickup mail, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, Roselawn would be a long walk.
Right, right. You can't really do that.
So where are we headed with this, Bill?
Very good question. Now that they've...
That's why I'm asking you.
Always got to throw me under the bus, don't you? Well, we've got, with this camp now in Over the Rhine, it looks like community housing, Over the Rhine Community Housing is getting involved. So I'm not sure what that tells me. The whole time people have been saying, well, there isn't enough room in the shelters. We can't go to the shelters. There isn't enough room. And yet, listening into a conference call involving Judge Timothy Black, district judge, and all the plaintiffs and the defendants, the city, the county, they brought in shelter representatives who say, yeah, we may be at capacity, but we can make room. We can find room. We have extra room. We will find you places. If it's a family, we will get motel rooms for you.
Yeah. I think that's that whole question of shelter capacity is so much more complicated than it sounds, because I was talking to Arlene Nolan, who runs Shelter House, the other day. Shelter House, of course, operates the Barron Center for Men in Queensgate and the Hatton Center for Women in Mount Auburn. And she was telling me that their shelters are over capacity constantly. The other night, the Hatton Center for Women has 60 beds. I think they had 80 women there. The Barron Center has, I think, technically 150 beds for men. They had 196 spending the night. So they're always over capacity. They won't turn people away, but does that mean there's room? I guess technically it means there's room. But the other thing is, you know, in interviewing a lot of these folks who are staying in these tents, they don't want to go to shelter. And some people will say that's because they're in active addiction, and that is an issue for some of them. But some of them have had traumatic experiences in shelters. They've been through other traumas, or they have mental health problems that make it difficult for them to sleep in groups. Or they're married couples or couples who are together in some way, and there are no shelters for couples who don't have children in the community. So it's a more complicated issue than I think maybe it sounds sometimes.
And there's one more group. No shelter in Hamilton County will accept someone who is a registered sex offender.
Right.
And I don't know that there are a lot who fall under that qualification. I'm told the camp beneath Fort Washington Way that was broken up last week, there was one person in that camp who was a registered sex offender and could not be taken in at any of the shelters. Told there was someone else who was barred from local shelters because of disruptive behavior, not to following the rules. And then I'm told there were 22 people in total staying there. And the caseworkers talked to all of them. They found those two. And of the other 20 that were told, you can come to the shelters, we will have room for you, I'm told none of them went.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah, there is real resistance to going into shelter. Okay, this is going to be an ongoing issue. This isn't going to disappear. But another issue has emerged this week, and that's the issue of a tasing by a Cincinnati police officer of an 11-year-old, a fifth grader, who was suspected of shoplifting from a grocery store and had an argument. So Cameron, what about this issue?
Well, so it happened Monday night. The 11-year-old girl who the Inquirer is, we're aware of her name, but we've chosen not to name her because she's so young, was at this store. There was a Cincinnati police officer working an off-duty security detail at the store. My understanding is he was in uniform, probably appeared just as he would when he was on duty. A lot of times that's how security details kind of work. He was suspected a group of girls that they were taking things. He had tried to approach one of them. She ignored his commands to stop, and he fired his taser at her, striking her in the back. And from what her family has said, she fell, went on the floor. They took her into custody. They took her to Children's Hospital to get evaluated, which is kind of standard protocol for a tasing. And then she was released into the custody of her mother. The news broke of this. The Cincinnati Police Department actually issued a press release, I believe, Wednesday evening or Tuesday evening to kind of get in front of it, basically. They spelled out what happened. And in that first press release, they Chief Elliot Isaac put a statement in there that said he was extremely concerned about the situation and that they were launching an investigation. So right now there's two separate investigations going on, one into the actions of the officer. His name is Kevin Brown. He's in his 50s. His personnel file has not been released yet, so we don't have a whole lot of information about how long he's been on the force or anything like that. And then there's another investigation into, maybe the better word might be an exploration into Cincinnati Police Department's taser policy. And that, I think, may have longer-term impacts and a little bit more debate amongst the community as, what is their standard operating procedure and was it followed and should it be changed is the bigger thing. So over the past week, we've been looking into their policy and going through as much of it as we can to try to get a better understanding of what happened.
It's the fallout after the incident, and it's been all over the place. I mean, all the way from the mayor and P.G. Sittenfeld on the one side, the head of the FOP. There's been lots of people weighing in on this, and that really sets up what we're going to do about this.
Yeah, sure. So the mayor came out. He apologized to the family. The Hamilton County prosecutor, Joe Dieters, basically said that this girl would face no charges. She was initially charged with theft and obstruction of justice. He came out and said, there's no way we're charging her criminally for anything. He also said that the police department normally would run something by that, like that by his office when a person is that young, 11 years old. And he said that the police department didn't do that in this case. Honestly, the only person who's really came out sort of against the general backlash to the tasing is FOP President Dan Hills, who basically said in a Facebook post that the more injuries could have been suffered had the officer physically engaged with the 11-year-old. He said that that could have resulted in lawsuits for Kroger and for
they could have fallen on the floor or somebody
things
could
like
have been
that.
Hurt.
Which honestly, that to clarify, based on what the family has told me, she fell on the floor when she got tased. So obviously, if someone's like tackling you, it might be worse. But she did fall on the floor when she got tased. There was that. The bigger question is the policy of the taser use that has been called into question and whether he followed the policy or not. There was a incident this spring where a young teenager was arrested near Hughes High School in Clifton. In that instance, the officer pointed and shot the taser at the teenager, but did not strike him with both prongs of the taser. There's two prongs that have to hit for the shock to happen. And at that point, we dove into the taser policy, and it covers it's rather open-ended, is what we've kind of discovered. the ages that they say is 7 to 70, which I think just sounds catchy more than anything else. But that's in their policy. Ages 7 to 70 is acceptable to use a taser on. They say don't use it on pregnant women. That, from what I understand, comes pretty much directly from the company that produces tasers. Taser themselves puts out guidelines, and a lot of the policy that Cincinnati police use comes directly from.
So you're picking up the companies.
The manufacturer's guidelines, exactly.
Tasers safe for second graders.
So
that's the slogan, right?
So the whole situation is the more nuanced part of it is that Cincinnati police can use are trained or are permitted to use, directed to use tasers on anyone who is, in quotes, actively resisting arrest, which covers a very, very wide range of behavior. That can be anything from someone who is not responding to commands to someone who is fighting with police, okay, with a weapon even. It covers all of that ground. And while the Cincinnati police, the procedure manual does say that fleeing the scene of a crime or leaving a officer cannot be the only reason that an officer uses a taser, there's a lot of open nuance to it. There's a lot of things that officers are told to consider.
Well, just a basic question. So police carry a gun. They carry a taser. Do all police carry tasers? I don't know. I'm not sure.
I think they're standard issue for Cincinnati police.
Okay. Sure, for a uniformed
patrol officer. Do police carry batons?
Well, baton is an issuable item. I'm not sure if every police officer carries them, but the procedure manual does cover use of batons as well.
So, okay. So what sort of reviews are taking place right now on this?
So there's two general things happening at the same time. First is a review of the officer's actions. And what that's going to do is it's going to look at whether he followed the procedure, whether he acted excessively, all of that kind of stuff. That's going to be his conduct versus the procedure itself.
And is that inside the police?
That's an internal review of the Cincinnati Police Department.
Okay, an
internal review by the Cincinnati Police Department. The second thing that's happening is that the Cincinnati Police Department, under the orders of Chief Elliot Isaac, has decided to review their taser policy. So they're, you know, the officer Kevin Brown will be judged against the current policy, but then there's a kind of a more wide angle discussion that's going to happen about whether that policy should be changed.
And who will be involved in that?
That, again, at least for the time being, is an internal review.
Because there are community groups who are saying that.
Well, there's another issue.
Ought to be have input here.
Yeah. Well, there's a whole nother issue kind of surrounding this that has been ongoing for months now, and that's the Citizens Complaint Authority. Right. And in recent, recent weeks, even it has been that recent, a judge has ordered that Cincinnati police officers do not have to submit to interviews with the Citizens Complaint Authority during active criminal investigations. So if an officer, for instance, shoots a suspect and then there's an active criminal investigation as part of that shooting, the Citizens Complaint Authority, which was mandated and set up as part of the collaborative agreement that came out of the 2001 riots, that they don't have to interview them. They have been able to in the past. They've been able to, in legal speak, compel officers to come and be interviewed by the Citizens Complaint Authority. But a judge has recently ruled that they no longer have to do that until the investigation's over.
So what's the status of the police officer who was involved in this tasing?
He has been put on restricted duty, which is not a super clear idea of what he's doing day to day. But he's been put on restricted duties.
And being paid at the moment.
I would imagine, yes.
Okay. For the rest of you who work in newsrooms, what sort of reaction are you hearing about this incident and the issues that it raises?
Well, here at WCPO, we've actually gotten quite a lot of feedback from people who are more supportive of the police officer. We got emails when our story went up initially saying, how big was this child? Some children are huge. And I think she was 90 pounds and 4 feet, a few inches tall on the police report.
She was 4 feet, 11 inches tall.
Oh, 4 feet, 11 inches
according
tall.
To the police report, 90 pounds. Yeah. And I actually did meet her. Again, we're not naming her because of she's so young, but I met her and compared to like a high school, she didn't look, she looked like her age basically.
Yeah.
She was young.
She looked like a middle school, elementary.
Grader. She looked like a fifth grader.
Okay.
Yeah.
And we've also heard from people just saying they think it's anti-police to focus on this whole issue, because if she was stealing, she should have stopped when the police officer told her to stop, and she got what she deserved. So that's some of the feedback we've gotten. Yeah.
And we've gotten feedback in the other direction too, where people have said, if an 11-year-old girl is feeling like she has to steal food, maybe that's a child services issue, not necessarily a criminal issue.
Do we actually know that it was food that was being stolen?
The family told me it was snacks that she took. And the mother did say, the mother, Donna Gowdy, who we have named, said that her daughter did admit that she had taken things.
Okay. I want to move on to the Children's Services levy, because two other levies, the sort of blinked. They didn't put their levy on. The Hamilton County Democratic majority pulled their
sales tax
increase, so they didn't have to face a issue on the fall ballot. Now this is on. What is the Children's Services levy about? What will it do?
Well, there's already a Children's Services levy in place. That was started in 1996. It's held steady at 2.77 mils since then. It's on a five-year cycle. Last time it was renewed was 2016, but it's apparently not generating enough money to meet the needs of Job and Family Services, specifically Children's Services. And so two of the three commissioners in Hamilton County brought up an idea, a bridge. Well, they didn't bring it up, but they passed it. It was suggested by the Tax Levy Review Committee, who said, here, we've got a bridge levy. And what this will do will generate enough money for us to get through till the next time this levy is due, and then we can increase it, hopefully.
I want to go back. In 2016, there was discussion about the need for an increase, and
yes,
that was rejected.
Yes. What they're going to do now is, if it passes in November, it'll add about $69 to every $100,000 worth of home you've got.
Yeah. Okay.
And it'll be up for a vote in November.
And what sort of services is this going to try to provide?
I believe it covers a lot of the child welfare services, as Bill was saying, and JFS has been arguing for some time that the agency has been overwhelmed, in part because of the opioid epidemic, with more and more children walking through the doors, more and more families needing help. And the Children's Services levy, for its history, has been passed pretty popularly by the voters, I believe. You can correct me if I'm wrong, Bill.
You're correct.
And the other piece of the equation is that Ohio has one of the lowest levels of state funding for child welfare agencies in the country.
We're 50th out of 50.
Yeah. So if for local communities that don't have levies like this to add to the funding that go into these programs and services, they're really in trouble. But Hamilton County, in a lot of ways, is fortunate to have this levy to support those services.
Chris Monzel has argued – he voted against this, putting it on the levy. He argued that, well, there's a surplus from a court decision, and that both – gubernatorial candidates have said they were interested in increasing the amount of money that Ohio puts into children's services. And why don't we just wait and see what they do? We don't have to go ahead now.
Commission President Todd Portune did not take well to that suggestion. He pointed out, look, part of the reason we're in this mess and we're not making enough money is because we've had this $65 million and we suggested using it a couple of years ago. And he told Chris Monzel, we didn't, because you suggested, let's wait and see what happens. And to the idea that a new administration will increase funding, Portoon says there's no indication that's going to happen. The administration or the legislature isn't going to change enough. We can't count on the state or the federal government to bail us out of this. We're going to have to do it ourselves.
Okay. So this is going to be on the ballot in November. This
yes.
is something people will have a chance to debate and vote on. So I'd like to thank all three of our guests, Lucy May, Cameron Knight, and Bill Reinhart. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. In Kentucky, every politician with something to say, and what politician doesn't have things to say, attends the annual Fancy Farm Picnic. This year, Governor Matt Bevin skipped the picnic and gave his opponents an open opportunity to launch attacks. And they did. Bevin's policies have energized a host of potential Democratic opponents and also the state's teachers. But before the governor's race next year, there's at least two congressional races in play this year. To help clarify what's at stake in Kentucky this year, we're joined now by State Capitol reporter for Kentucky Public Radio, Ryland Barton, and Associated Press reporter, Adam Beam. Because we have both of our guests on the line, we are not able to take calls during this segment. Ryland, Adam, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Hi, Dan.
Thanks for having us.
Good. Ryland, for those people in our listening area who are north of the river and don't understand what the Fancy Farm Picnic is, give us a quick summary and why it plays such a big role in Kentucky politics.
Sure. Fancy Farm is Kentucky's premier political event. It happens the first Saturday of August every year. And basically, anybody who's running for statewide office in Kentucky, then some local politicians out in western Kentucky, they show up at Fancy Farm and they give these stump speeches. It's also sitting elected officials as well. And what's really strange about it is it's this event where members of both parties are up on stage and they're more or less just roasting each other. It's very policy light. And more personality focused, and it's just and you have this big old audience that's really rowdy and yelling, trying to shout down the candidates, and it's been going on for a really long time since the late 19th century, and it's just a real circus every year.
A real circus. Okay, Adam, did Bevin skip the picnic this year because he thought it was just going to be too rowdy, too much of a circus, sort of pointless? Or because he's thinking he might not run for re-election? There is some talk out there that may be what's in play here.
Well, nobody really knows why he skipped it, because he won't say why he skipped it, or at least he hasn't publicly given a reason whenever we have asked. But I do know that since I've covered Governor Bevin since his 2014 race against Senator McConnell, and he does not like Fancy Farm. Every time he goes there, he just doesn't like the setup. He doesn't like the environment. And, his first – when he was there running for governor, he famously refused to criticize his opponent and just had everybody stand up and give the Pledge of Allegiance. So I think he just doesn't like going there, first of all, and he feels like he's not on the ballot, so he doesn't have to. I think a lot of Republicans in the state are a little frustrated with that because, while, yeah, he's not on the ballot in 2018 – he is on the ballot. He will be on the ballot if he runs for re-election in 2019, and he already has an announced opponent in Andy Beshear, the Democratic Attorney General. And Andy Beshear did go to Fancy Farm and spent most of his speech on statewide television criticizing the governor. So I think a lot of Republicans were kind of frustrated that he skipped it. But this is who Bevin is. He doesn't go places he doesn't want to go. He kind of does his own thing.
Well, and Andy Beshear isn't the only Democrat thinking about, he's declared, but there's other Democrats who are thinking about running and are pretty vocal about it, really, right?
Absolutely. And what's really interesting about Fancy Farm every year, I think the most important story is not what is said on the stage, but what happens off the stage. And that was the case this year, especially when it comes to the race for the Democratic nomination for governor. So the question is always, okay, who shows up at Fancy Farm? And what do they say? And this year, a lot of the focus was on the Democrats. You had Allison Lundergan Grimes. You had who's the Secretary of State, who famously ran against Senator McConnell in 2014 and lost. And then you had Adam Edlin, a former state auditor, who surprisingly lost his reelection campaign in 2015, but has been sticking around and staying around and staying involved in Kentucky politics. And then you have Rocky Adkins, who's the House Minority Leader, who's making news and waves about running, plus State Representative Attica Scott from Louisville. All of these people, they all showed up, and they all kind of gave messages to each other. And the message was, we need to be focusing on 2018 and focusing on our state house and trying to get our state Democrats elected to the state House of Representatives. And that was kind of a not-so-veiled shot, I believe, at Andy Beshear, who has already announced this campaign and is already raising money. And so I think this is kind of a sign that we're going to see a potentially vigorous, robust Democratic primary for governor, something that the Democratic Party has not seen in Kentucky for a number of years.
Well, let's talk about some issues. Governor Bevin has been trying to take the lead nationally on changing eligibility standards on Medicaid, but it's run into some problems in the courts. And from a legal point of view, where do things stand with this changing Medicaid policy and eligibility questions?
Well, a federal judge in Washington, D.C., struck down the changes that Governor Bevin wants to make to Medicaid. And the changes that he wants to make is he wants to require some people who are on Medicaid to pay monthly premiums. They're very small, but they're still, right now they don't pay anything. And they would be required to either have a job or, volunteer for community service or take a class or a job training course in order to remain eligible for their benefits. And a judge in Washington, D.C. struck that down basically 2 or 3 days before the changes were supposed to go into effect. And it really kind of sent the whole place into kind of a state of chaos. Nobody really knew what to do. The governor originally ended up eliminating dental and vision benefits for people who were on the expanded Medicaid program in Kentucky. He has since rescinded that. And now what we're in right now is the federal government has started the process of basically reevaluating these new rules that Governor Bevin proposed, starting the approval process over again. And meanwhile, the governor and others are appealing this judge's ruling. So you kind of have two tracks going. On one, the federal government is starting this process of potentially reapproving these changes. At the same time, you have the process winding its way through the courts. Who knows which one will finish first? My bet would be on the federal government finishing its approval process first, because the court system usually takes a while for those appellate issues to go forward. So who knows what's going to happen after that?
So, Rylan, the fact that vision and dental care and emergency transportation to health facilities has been restored, was that seen, or is that seen as a concession that Bevin just had to make, and what are the implications of having had to go back on that policy?
I think that the governor's office, they don't want to say that they were they elected to rescind the vision and dental benefits. They're saying that the court ruling basically forced them to do that. Originally, they were saying that was because the state couldn't afford to provide those benefits without that waiver being approved. And then, I think that because of the turmoil over the first couple weeks there, 2 or 3 weeks after the waiver was struck down, I think, they had to fold because of, there's some pretty crazy stories coming out of people who had, already had, big dental appointments scheduled, or people who are all of a sudden, on Friday they had vision benefits, and then on Monday they didn't. It was a real 180 for a lot of these people.
Okay, so let's take a look at one of the congressional races, and probably the one that is the most fiercely contested right now, at least from the distance, that's what it looks like, is in the 6th congressional district. Republican incumbent Andy Barr is being challenged by Democrat Amy McGrath, and that has been heating up on television and on radio with some new rounds of ads being put out there, which are very critical of Amy McGrath. So how do you see that race shaping up in light of the big national trends that everybody's looking at and talking about, whether it's a blue wave or a red wave or whatever?
Well, that district, the 6th district around Lexington, it's a it's really considered to be a perfect purple district. It's got kind of an urban center and then a whole lot of rural area around it. And over the last 20 years, it's switched political affiliation several times. And yeah, the districts, the race has certainly been heating up over the last couple of weeks. We've seen the first ads come out, some attack ads coming from Andy Barr and from other groups who are outside groups who are involved in the race, and then Amy McGrath responding now with some ads attacking Andy Barr for attacking her. The political season's just kind of heating up now, and this is certainly a race that a lot of people across the country have their eyes on. It's a place where people feel that a sitting Republican might be vulnerable to a Democrat flipping. Of course, Amy McGrath's she's a retired Marine fighter pilot, and that's that's part of what Democrats are really pushing for. If a blue wave happens, both being a woman and a veteran, two things that they're hoping work in her favor. And Andy Barr, he's been in office since 2000. Adam, help me out. 2008, when he first took defeated Ben Chandler.
2010.
2010. And so yeah, he's been there for a little bit. And I mean, their big criticism of McGrath is that she recently moved to the district, after a career in the military, both living abroad and in Washington, D.C. And she grew up in northern Kentucky, actually.
Yeah.
And then also in these attack ads recently, they've been going after, saying she's too liberal for Kentucky. Saying that with clips of her saying that she's a feminist and pro-choice. That's kind of what they're running now, saying that really banking on this kind of conservative voters coming out to support the congressman.
So
to me, the most fascinating part about that race is the district itself, because you look at the district and you think, oh, this has got to be a traditionally Democratic district, because it includes the second largest city, Lexington, includes the University of Kentucky. You got the university atmosphere there, and it also includes the state capital of Frankfort, all the state government workers. All of these are big traditional pool of Democratic voters, but you also include all these kind of ring counties eastern Kentucky that are more conservative. So the question, it really comes down to who can turn out their base the most. And in this election, the Democrats are the most energized. They're the most excited they've been in a long time. And it's been a question of, can the Republicans match that? And so the Republicans are having to really work hard to try to get their voters out to match that enthusiasm on the Democrat side.
Well, that's one of the challenges for those of us who either are from – I'm originally from northern Kentucky, or people live in Ohio trying to observe Kentucky politics. Northern Kentucky is so rock-ribbed Republican that it's hard to even imagine that there's Democratic support in the rest of Kentucky. So how would you evaluate where the Democratic Party is in Kentucky? It took a real beating in the last election, lost the House. It's got to come back from something. How would you evaluate things?
Well, I agree with you that Republicans really rule the state now. But it wasn't that long ago when that wasn't the case. Democrats controlled the House of Representatives as recently as 2016. Governor Matt Bevin replaced a two-term Democratic governor. When I first came here in 2014, a majority of the state constitutional officers were Democrats. So it's really been kind of a more recent phenomenon that Republicans have come to dominate state politics. And, that's why I think this election coming up is so pivotal for the future of Kentucky, because it's like the voters here are going to decide, all right, what state are we going to be? Are we going to be this reliable, red state that so many, you know, of states in the South are and have become? Or are we going to become this purple state that is more, you know, open to the winds of political change? Are we going to be more vulnerable to movements like the teachers' movement and this backlash against President Trump? So that's why I think this election is really critical for that. And, you know, I think Republicans have the advantage as far as voter registration. While they don't have a majority of voter registration, they have made tremendous gains in voter registration over the past year, much more than the Democrats have. So they seem to have momentum. The Democrats, of course, they have the, like I talked about earlier, this enthusiasm. This, you know, they're motivated, highly motivated to try to reject President Trump. But at the same time, you know, Trump remains highly popular in this state, and so popular that, you know, you have people like Senator Mitch McConnell that are moving forward to try to show their support for him in this state. So it's really a pivotal race here, in my opinion.
Do you expect President Trump to weigh in on this 6th district race?
That's a great question. You know, I don't know. I think it depends on whether the Andy Barr campaign wants him to, because that district has been such a purple district in the past that, you know, it could do you more harm than good if you think about it. It's kind of like how, you know, when Alison Lundergan Grimes was running for the Senate in 2014, President Obama, while of course, you know, he wanted her to win, never really said anything about her or came here because he knew he would be a liability. And I think that that's what the Barr campaign is kind of weighing right now, with whether to have Trump come here or not.
Let's go back to an issue which I really know nothing about except what I've read, and that is Governor Bevin hiring this couple from Florida, Chris and Alicia Johnson, who are going to be special advisors on the question of adoption and foster care. Why is he interested in this? And by the way, I'm sure one of you can tell us about the controversy over how much they're actually getting paid or what this is going to cost. Why is he doing this, and what's their portfolio? What's he want them to do?
Governor Bevin, you know, he's made the adoption and foster care system a really big priority for him. Kentucky has had a lot of problems with its child welfare system. A lot of kids who were just fall through the cracks. There's a lot of abuse and neglect, even within the foster care system. And so he's really made it a priority to try to get in there and reform that and change that. And there's various ways you can go about doing that. What he likes to do is bring in these outside advisors to help. He did this soon after he got elected. He brought in a Southern Baptist minister from the nearby Southern Theological Seminary in Louisville. His name was Daniel Dumas, and gave him a $240,000 a year contract, and he was supposed to be an advisor. His role was really undefined, and yet he left that job, I want to say about 6 months after he started, under mysterious circumstances. Nobody ever really, you know, explained why he left. And then a few months later, we get news that he's hiring Chris and Alicia Johnson. Chris Johnson is a Baptist minister. Alicia is his wife. They have 10 children. I think 3 of them are biological, and the 7 others they've adopted. And they've, you know, fostered more than 40 children in their home. So Governor Bevin looks at them as a child welfare expert, given their experience adopting and raising foster kids. Now, the flip side of that is, you know, a lot of critics will look to them and say, yeah, I mean, they have experience personally, but they're not child welfare experts. They don't have social work degrees and, you know, have been devoted to, they've spent their life mostly in Christian ministry, not, you know, in the social foster care system. They feel like it's not appropriate to bring them on.
And what are they getting paid?
They're getting paid, I think, $82,000 a year each, $82,500 each. So around $165,000 a year total for both of them.
Okay. And there's a lot of questions about other things, travel expenses, and one report says that the budget for this is going to go to $350,000. So kind of an interesting development. So one other issue ran across was the abolition of the board, a 13-member board to oversee worker safety in Kentucky, and Democrats asking for this to be restored, and the administration making it pretty clear they weren't interested in that. Where does that stand, and what's really at stake here?
This is something the governor's done several times throughout his administration, is either abolishing or reshaping various state boards and commissions. And also another thing that's happened is that opponents have raised a lot of alarms about it. This board, it makes recommendations of workplace safety, Democrats from the state legislature wrote to the governor asking him to restore the board, and saying that him abolishing it violates state law. I think that the administration's argument is that the board really hasn't even made all that many recommendations over the past years. The state said it's only met 11 times since 2008. It's just kind of one thing the governor's done is just kind of reshaping the way the executive branch works a bit. And one way he's done that is just kind of changing.
Is there a legitimate argument that he's trying to streamline here?
I think there's always an argument to be made, but I'm not totally sure how much this particular board has done, although having a board looking over safety regulations is certainly important.
Yeah. State law gives the Kentucky governor wide latitude to make changes to state government when the legislature's not in session. Governor Bevin has been probably one of the more active governors in taking advantage of that law. The question of whether or not he can do things like this is before the state Supreme Court. So that question is still to be answered, really, is how much farther he can go on this. So this is one example of many of him taking advantage of this law to make changes to state government when the state legislature's not in session.
Well, I'd like to thank both of you, Ryland Barton and Adam Beam, for being with us today. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstrow. Archives of our programs are available on the website, WVXU.org. I'm Dan Hurley. A path to college or a more direct line to a job. How CPS is expanding its career pathway. We take a look on the next Cincinnati Edition as part of the ongoing initiative American Graduate Getting to Work. Plus, a traveling feast. A writer cooks up a scheme to thank his literary heroes through some unforgettable meals. That's Monday on Cincinnati Edition at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.